The following is an encore presentation of Access Utah. However, you can still participate in this conversation at upraccess@gmail.com.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In her book, Fields of Blood, Religion, and the History of Violence, acclaimed author Karen Armstrong writes that in the West, the idea of that religion is inherently violent is now taken for granted, seems self-evident. As one who speaks on religion, she says, I constantly hear how cruel and aggressive it's been, a view that eerily is expressed in the same way almost every time. Religion has been the cause of all the major wars in history. Armstrong asserts that the problem lies not with the multifaceted activity we call religion, but in the violence embedded in our human nature and the nature of the state. Dr. Karen Armstrong is a scholar, author, and commentator, as well as a former Roman Catholic nun. Leaving the convent in 1969, she pursued an understanding of major religions and their common understandings of compassion and the Golden Rule. The book A History of God was published in 1993. Several other bestsellers have followed. And she was awarded the TED Prize fairly recently, 2008, to launch the Charter for Compassion. Karen Armstrong, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about your background before we get into this this subject. You set out to be a Catholic nun. I think you were a nun for a while.
I was a nun for 7 years when I was a young girl. I was far too young. I was only 17 when I entered my convent, far too young to make a decision like that. But I was a stubborn teenager, wouldn't listen to anybody. And I eventually had to leave. Not very many people can live lives of total poverty, total chastity, total obedience, and I was not one of them. And I left, though with great sadness, really, after 7 years, and then pursued my studies at Oxford University.
And you've said that you became a Dawkins-esque atheist.
I'd had a difficult time in my convent. I'd seen religion perhaps in its less positive phase. There wasn't much kindness in there, not much compassion. I found that God just simply dropped away from me. And I wanted nothing to do with religion ever again, as I thought. But, you know, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be doing what I had to what I'm doing today. I mean, in a sense, my life is rather nun-like. I've never married. I live alone, and I spend my days these days writing, talking, and thinking about God and spirituality, which is probably the kind of thing I was hoping to do when I entered the convent.
You ended up in that kind of life anyway. So you are famous as a writer about religion. How did that happen?
A series of career disasters. This was not what I intended to do at all. I studied English literature at Oxford, and my plan was to become a professor of English literature teaching in a university. That didn't happen. I failed my PhD at Oxford with horrible publicity. Then I became a school teacher for some years, and for 6 years I taught English literature, English in a girls' school in London, and lost my job because of ill health. I have a form of epilepsy. Then I fell into television for a while. I had published my first book at that time about my life in the convent, and television Channel 4 was just opening up in London, and they rang me up and asked me if I'd like to write and present a 6-part documentary series on St. Paul in Jerusalem, working with an Israeli film company. And I said yes, because I was out of work, and it was there that I became interested, first of all, in the Middle East and its problems. But also there, I encountered Judaism and Islam for the first time. In Jerusalem, you bump into these faiths at every turn, and you find them jostling, sometimes uneasily, with Christianity at the same sites, sacred sites. And I started to study these other faiths and found that there was much in them that appealed to me that I could really relate to, and they also showed me what my own Christianity had been trying to do at its best, and that's really when I started studying world religion.
And then I think it's 9/11, it's post 9/11 that propelled you into a much more public role. You became
unfortunately
a,
yes
yeah.
I had by that time written a biography of the Prophet Muhammad. I'd written a book on religious fundamentalism and a short history of Islam. And after 9/11, people were, in the United States particularly, were very anxious to learn about Islam. And so I was actually in America at the time. I was packing to come to the United States when the atrocity actually happened on September the 11th. I was supposed to fly out the following day. And when I finally got to America, I was spending some time at Harvard University. I really didn't see the inside of a library because trying to explain what had happened, why had happened, and that you couldn't put this all down to religion.
Mm-hmm. And as you write in the book, our modern times are exceedingly violent. And
yes.
Some are saying, and it seems like to be a growing number of voices, that religion is just inherently violent. And of course, Islam is front and center, and some people are saying Islam is just inherently violent. And of course, this book is a rebuttal to that. I wonder what do you say? This thing that you say you encountered this idea from taxi drivers and, you know, just people on the street, that religion's been the cause of all the major wars in history. I wonder if we could start there. What do you say to that?
It's an odd remark, really, because the two world wars of the last century were not caused by religion, obviously. They were caused by secular nationalism. Historians of warfare tell us that we never go to war for a single reason. There are always multiple interlocking motivations involved, financial, economic, territorial, political, social, all of them, and religion is just one of those factors. And that if we concentrate solely on religion and fail to take these other factors into account, we're behaving very irrationally and not looking at the situation we're in with it logically and clearly, which is what we need at the moment. Also, experts in terrorism tell us that whatever the motivation involved, whatever the ideology, terrorism is always inherently political. It's always about changing the status quo. It's always about trying to force a regime to change its policies or to grab power or to unseat a regime from power. But it's never entirely due to religion. And it struck me that this is just a lazy and inaccurate and indeed prejudiced way of looking at the current situation we're in, which is very dangerous and which we need all our wits about us and take everything into account.
Mm.
I'm not saying that religion is not implicated in these atrocities. Obviously it is. But it's never the sole, nor is it ever even the chief reason.
I wonder if we talk about 9/11. You take on, several violent events, especially in the modern. Well, you go back to ancient Sumerians, but to bring it forward to the modern world. So 9/11. You hear the words jihad, and the 9/11 attackers are all Muslim, and at least some of them are talking about the fact that they're doing this for Islam.
Yeah. Let's start with that word jihad, for example. It's now become a sort of English word now, hasn't it? It's entered our vocabulary, and we think of it as essential to Islam, a central tenet. But in fact, the word jihad and its derivatives occurs only 47 times in the whole of the Quran, and in only 10 of those instances does it refer unequivocally to warfare. The word means endeavor, struggle. And the Quran says it's also a jihad, a struggle, an effort to give food to somebody when you have very little food yourself. That's also a jihad. And sometimes you have to fight, but always only in self-defense and you know, and as soon as your enemy sues for peace, the Quran says you must at once stop fighting, laying down your arms. All the world religions which have become involved with the state have developed a military ideology. Part of the problem is our understanding of the word religion. We in the modern West think of religion as something, as a sort of separate activity, something set apart from secular activities such as politics or statecraft. We see it as an ideology centered usually on a supernatural god with a defined set of beliefs and practices and a particular organization. But no other culture has anything like this idea of religion. And it would seem very strange to people even in Europe before about the year 1700. In the pre-modern world, religion permeated all activities. The Oxford English Dictionary, Oxford Classical Dictionary, tells us that there's no word in Greek or Latin that corresponds to the English religion or religious. And in Arabic, the word din, which we translate as religion, means a whole way of life. So religion permeated all activities. Like just as you put flavoring into a cake, for example, and it goes right the way through the entire cake, and you can't take that flavor out and separate it. Religion was to do with social life, domestic life, and political life, because we're meaning-seeking creatures, and we always want to find some ultimate value in what we do. And so when we created civilizations, which are all founded on force and maintained by force, and religion, the warfare acquired a sacral activity too. But that's true of every single world faith that's been entangled with statecraft and government.
So then religious versus secular, that's a fairly modern thing, isn't it? We want to see ourselves as secular.
We regard ourselves as secular. That means the word secular means the world. Comes from the Latin saeculum, and we've separated religion and politics at the time of the Enlightenment in the West. It was a very important part of our modernization, and in many ways, it's been good for religion because. When a faith like Christianity, which preaches absolute equality and justice for all without exception, when that gets tangled up with state and government, all states have inherent inequalities. All states are inherently violent. No state, however peaceable it is, can ever afford to disband its army. And so inevitably, a tradition that may have started out very peaceably, but will become, will acquire a militant wing. And so for us in the West, secularism was part of our modernization. It was part of the way we created the modern world. In other parts of the world, however, it has been more problematic. Secularism in the Muslim world, for example, after the colonial period, was often imposed very violently. We had a couple of centuries to develop our secular institutions, and we were able to do so at our own pace, according to our own dynamic. We didn't have to follow somebody else's program. But in the Middle East, for example, people had to secularize very fast. It was felt as something foreign, something imposed on the people, not coming from their own inner dynamic. And very often it was imposed violently. The Shahs in Iran used to make their soldiers go out with their bayonets, taking off the women's veils with their bayonets and ripping them to pieces in front of them. in 1935, the Shah gave his soldiers orders to shoot at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators who, in one of the holiest shrines of Iran, who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western dress. And hundreds of Iranians were killed that day. The Muslim Brotherhood, which began as simply a reforming institution, acquired a militant edge in prison, where President Nasser in the 1950s interred thousands of members of the Muslim Brotherhood, often without trial, often for doing nothing more incriminating than handing out leaflets. And in these horrible jails, they became radicalized. So secularism, which we have found to be positive and liberating in the West, liberating not least for religion, has often been experienced as disturbing, cruel, and even violent in other parts of the world, where it's been imposed as something foreign and not something that people have developed under their own steam.
Let's take a break. When we come back, more with Karen Armstrong. You've likely read her books. She's a scholar, author, commentator. And the latest book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. And it's out in paperback with a postscript, in which Karen Armstrong responds to some events that have happened after the publication of the hardback book, including the Charlie Hebdo incident in France, also the rise of ISIS. We'll talk about those things and a bit of the history here as we go along today. More following the break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the 24th Annual Moab Music Festival. Presenting the Rene Rosnes Quartet, Schubert, Beatles, and classic contemporary chamber music, September 1st through the 12th. Information at moabmusicfest.org.
So I've got a question for you guys. Why do you volunteer at Utah Public Radio?
Well, it's because I support quality programming.
I like to volunteer to support the local NPR member station.
You get to watch the people do what they do, make radio magic.
That sounds awesome. I want to volunteer. How do I sign up?
The pledge drive is September 10th to the 16th. Just go to upr.org.
That's upr.org.
And look for the blue box to sign up for your time slot.
The following is an encore presentation of Access Utah. However, you can still participate in this conversation at upraccess@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is acclaimed author Karen Armstrong. She's authored numerous books on religion, including The Case for God, A History of God, The Battle for God, Holy War, Islam, Buddha, and The Great Transformation. There's a memoir called The Spiral Staircase. And she was awarded the TED Prize and has been working on the Charter for Compassion. We'll talk about that as we go along as well. The latest book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. And there's a postscript updating, responding to current events in the paperback version of the book. Karen Armstrong, no doubt you've heard some of these arguments put forward by people like Sam Harris and Bill Maher. I want to read this just a brief section from Bill Maher. This is from his program. This is from September. He says that he's calling out his fellow liberals. He says, liberals hear no evil and speak no evil when it comes to misogyny and Islam. He cites 98% of Somalian women have suffered female genital mutilation. And then he says, to count yourself as a liberal, you have to stand up for liberal principles like freedom of speech, freedom to practice any religion you want without fear of violence, freedom to leave a religion, equality for women, equality for minorities, including homosexuals. These are liberal principles. But then when you say that in the Muslim world this is lacking, they get upset. And so this is moving away a little bit from the terrorism, but problems. Is seen in the Muslim world. And as Sam Harris puts it, he calls Islam the motherlode of bad ideas. I wonder how you respond.
Well, we've had this. The West has been at loggerheads with Islam ever since the Crusades. I think what you're seeing in Islam today is people who have not yet fully modernized. I mean, it wasn't in the Christian world. Before the modern period, people who were left the faith were persecuted for that. Homosexuality was certainly not allowed even in my childhood in the UK. In 1962, until 1962, we were still putting homosexuals into prison. And you had exactly this gender inequality. It was part of the pre-modern package, and it occurs in all faiths, even those that claim total equality. Islam, actually, as regards women, Islam, the Quran, which was revealed in the 7th century, gave women rights of inheritance and divorce that Western women wouldn't have until the 20th century. They had legal rights that the Western women just wouldn't have at that time. And the Quran has a good message to women, just as the New Testament does. But then, of course, most faiths get dragged back into the old patriarchy. What we're seeing here is a people who are still in the process of modernization, which is always a very, very difficult rite of passage. It was difficult for us. We are still not quite sure how to live in the modern world. We've got all kinds of problems. But these wild remarks about Islam by people like Sam Harris, just they're not accurate and they're not helpful at this time. We've got big problems at the moment. We don't need to create fictional problems too.
Hmm. Now, you know, tolerance is a great thing, right? And we want to be tolerant. We want to check ourselves against Islamophobia.
Yeah, I'm not keen on the word tolerance, actually. Yeah.
Are you? You're not.
Yeah, if you look at the Latin derivation of that name, it comes from the Latin root that means to put up with something.
Okay, yeah.
And I think we've got to go further than tolerance. Mm. I think we need to start appreciating one another and respecting other. No one really wants to be tolerated. They want to be respected. And I think let's move beyond tolerance.
Mm. So, beyond tolerance to, as you say, respect.
Respect.
What else?
Respect, I think.
Okay.
To just see one another as equal with problems. We all have problems, but to see one another, each other as equals, not putting up with people as though this was some kind of dreary duty.
So respect. So how do we go about that, given the fact that, and we've got problems too, but as we see it in the Muslim world, it's some very real problems that we, female genital mutilation, we hardly disapprove of that, I think rightly so, in the Western world. How much of that is religion and how much is custom and culture? Do we tease that out and is that important?
That's really, that's not an Islamic problem. It's chiefly an African problem. When Islam went into Africa during its imperial days, it picked up some Muslims practiced that, but it's an African practice. Nothing in the Quran about that.
Hmm. You write in the book that we are increasingly interconnected and at the same time increasingly polarized.
Yes.
And that's tough to navigate.
We've created a world in which a global market in which we're deeply interdependent. Economically, we're interdependent. When stocks fall in one part of the world, the markets plummet all around the globe that day. We face the same environmental problem. We're interconnected electronically on the World Wide Web. Politically now, what happens in Afghanistan today or Pakistan today can have repercussions in London or New York tomorrow. Our job now is to take what our scriptures all tell us, scriptures in all faiths tell us, we have to observe compassion, respect, for all peoples, love your enemies, said Jesus. Love the stranger, says Leviticus. Reach out to all tribes and nations, says the Quran. And I think unless we do that now, unless we implement the golden rule globally, do not treat others as you would not like to be treated yourself, the world is simply not going to be a viable place. So we now need to recognize that we can't live without one another. Our only hope of surviving on this planet is to respect other people's problems. And if we British had behaved according to the golden rule in our colonies when we had an empire, I don't think we'd be having so many political problems today.
How much of this can be laid at the Western world? How much of this blame? This cycle
of
violence.
Let's just look at Britain for a moment. The partition of Palestine, for example, was our British idea. The partition of India, which was a catastrophic mistake in many ways, when India was divided into India and Pakistan, 7 million people were displaced and 1 million people died in the ensuing chaos as they split up these countries. One of the things that interconnects us is that our histories are interconnected. Just before the break, you mentioned IS or ISIS. This is the direct outcome of the Iraq War, which has helped to destabilize the region. The roots of ISIS lie in the insurgency that developed against the American and British occupation of the country. So we've acted in these regions, and we've acted in them, particularly in the Middle East, because of oil, and that has had repercussions because our actions always have consequences. And it's important that we recognize this I mentioned earlier that I went to Jerusalem years back in the 1980s to make a television program about St. Paul. I was working in Jerusalem, and I knew nothing when I arrived in Jerusalem about the Arab-Israeli conflict. But talking to both the Palestinians and Israelis, I found the one thing they had in common was how awful the British had been. And I realized, well, it's not just the Middle East problem. In a sense, it's our British problem, too, where we are somehow involved in that. Our histories are intertwined. And I think one of the things that is troubling to me about the modern world is that we don't learn enough history. We can't really understand individuals unless we know about their past. What sufferings they've endured in the past, what makes them wake up in the night in fear, what are their joys, what are their great achievements. Unless we know a person's past, we will never fully understand or value them. And we need to know now other people's histories as well as our own.
I wonder if we could follow up on ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. You write in the book, many Western people believe that Islamic State is decisive proof that Islam is chronically addicted to violence. So why is it not?
Well, as I said right at the beginning, I'm not saying religion's not implicated in all of this. Obviously, it is. Just as Christianity was implicated in the Crusades or the Inquisition. But the core leadership of IS is secular. The leaders, the original leaders, which developed during this movement, which developed during the insurgency following the Iraq War, they were all members of Saddam's disbanded army. That is, they were secular socialist Baathists. So here you have a perfect example of something that is religious as well as secular, a mixture, as it were. The French hostage who was held for 10 months by IS said that the discourse of his captors was extremely secular, and that when the hostages asked if they could have a Quran, they didn't have one handy. A journalist writing for Foreign Policy magazine was talking to IS supporters in Jordan, and he said they never once raised the topic of religion. It was that their talk was secular, and when the call to prayer came, and in Amman you can't miss the call to prayer, it's quite deafening, none of them got up to pray. So there's a strong secularist core to IS, and also a lot of religion. But all these people who are flocking to join the IS, they're not all devout Muslims. Two wannabe jihadis who left Britain last year to join the IS had ordered from Amazon a book called Islam for Dummies.
Wow.
Which shows you this kind of the level of Islamic knowledge that they had. Forensic psychiatrists have interviewed all the people in Guantanamo Bay who were involved in the 9/11 plot. So that's about some 500 people. And one of them, Mark Sageman, has published his findings, and he wasn't a liberal softie like me. He was a former CIA officer. And he said that of all these people, only about 20% of them had had a regular Muslim upbringing. The others were either new converts, and with the very sketchy knowledge of Islam, or else they were self-taught, like the guys that bought Islam for Dummies. And that many of them know very little about the Quran. They often don't start studying it seriously until they get to prison. He said that the problem is not Islam, he decided, but at rather ignorance of Islam. If they knew about the whole faith, this might have deterred them from their crimes. The biggest reason that they found is for people going off to join these movements has been a sense of meaninglessness, a sense of futility in life. I was talking last year in Britain to one of our chief military philosophers, and he said that what has driven young men to the battlefield all over the centuries, throughout history, has been boredom, a sense of life being sort of trivial and meaninglessness and pointless. In many cases, too, many of them belong to immigrant groups in Britain who don't feel that they are appreciated by the host culture. They feel they're marginalized, and therefore there's a sort of sense of grievance there, too. But things are much more complicated than just people reading the Quran and then immediately race off to join IS. There's a lot of multiple interlocking secular as well as religious passions involved.
Before we go to another break, I wonder if you'd give me your take on the shootings at Charlie Hebdo. This is January 7th of this year. 12 journalists were shot there.
Yes, that was a dreadful action, a crime. There's a number of things to be said about it. Number one, we didn't spend any time. We were so struck by the Charlie Hebdo. There was not much discussion of the holding up of the killings in the Jewish supermarket, even though the hijacker there specifically said he was acting on behalf of the Palestinians. So again, we were ignoring the political and looking at the just at the shootings in the magazine, and it assumed that it was just out of sheer fanaticism. The fanatical devotion to the Prophet Muhammad. But Al-Qaeda took responsibility for that shooting, and Al-Qaeda always has a political motive. Its aim is to create a clash of civilizations. And here, this was a clash between, they say, you attack our sacred value, which is the Prophet Muhammad, and we'll attack yours, that is freedom of speech, which is a sacred value to us in the West, not because it's supernatural, but because it is so deeply embedded in our way of life, in our economy, in the way we think, and that it's unnegotiable. But we have to remember that freedom of speech, which was developed during the Enlightenment, and freedom generally, liberty, was only ever for Europeans. John Locke, who was the person who first philosopher to separate religion and politics, and was also wrote a book about toleration. That tolerance did not apply to either Muslims or Catholics. He said the liberal state could not tolerate either liberals or Catholics. And here in the United States, we're founded on the principles of the Enlightenment, on liberty above all. All men are created equal, this very proud assertion. But there was no liberty for the slaves, who the African slaves on the toiling on the American plantations, and no liberty for the Native Americans. And so from the very first, our Enlightenment freedoms were freedoms only for Europeans. And many of the political leaders, including my own prime minister, who were marching for freedom that day, had for decades, they headed countries that had for decades supported regimes in Muslim-majority countries, such as Iran or Egypt, which had denied their people any freedom of expression at all. Massive support for Saudi Arabia, for example. Mm. So freedom has a double A. It's wonderful for us, and we in the West enjoy freedom, but this is not always been the case for people in other parts of the world. There was very little freedom of self-determination for the Muslims during their difficult rite of passage to modernity under British or French rule in the colonial period.
But if you bring it forward, we hope we've made progress on some of those things, expanding freedom for more
yes.
classes of people in our society. And there is a strain of idealism, I think, you know, when we say we're going to try to export democracy around the world, including in the, you know, the,
yeah.
the Muslim world.
Absolutely. We want to do that, but it's still far off. You see, democracy is something that we developed, again, under our own steam. I think there was a huge survey taken after 9/11 by the Gallup poll, which took place over 7 years in 35 Muslim-majority countries. And the results were extremely interesting. One of the top three things that respondents admired about the West, whether they were politically radical or politically conservative, was our democracy and freedom. They'd like some more democracies for themselves. And very often we have supported governments that have denied them this.
Let's take another break. When we come back, more with Karen Armstrong. Her latest book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. More following the break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Connections 2016 Common Literature Experience. How We Got to Now by Stephen Johnson, this year's convocation speaker. August 26th at 7 p.m. in the D. Glenn Smith Spectrum. Details at usu.edu/connections/literature-experience.
The following is an encore presentation of Access Utah. However, you can still participate in this conversation at upraccess@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah today. We reached our last segment with Karen Armstrong, acclaimed author, best-selling author of many books on religion. The latest is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence, which is now out in paperback with a postscript responding to Islamic State and Charlie Hebdo, who we've talked about here. Here's an argument I've heard several times. I wonder what you think about this. It goes something like this. That there's a timeline of development for religions, and Islam is just in its violent phase.
I don't think that's. I think that's rather. I don't think that works really. I think you have to remember that what the violent actions that we are seeing are committed by very, very few Muslims indeed, and that suicide bombing, for example. Was created not by religious people, but by the Tamil Tigers, who had no time for religion at all. It's more a question, I think, of a difficult passage to modernity here. Every single fundamentalist movement that I've studied in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam begins with what is perceived to be an assault by the liberal or secular establishment. And secularism, as I've said earlier in the program, has been imposed so violently in the Muslim world that it has often pushed some Muslims into a more radical stance. I don't take that really. Some people say, for example, well, they've never had a reformation like we've had. But Islam, like Christianity before the Protestant Reformation, had many reform movements. Every single one of the world religions, Islam included, began as a reformation of an existing spirituality. We shouldn't privilege our Protestant Reformation and think of it as a unique occurrence. It was important only because it coincided with the birth of our modernization. I think it's much more a question of there's a distinct difference, as I've said throughout this conversation, between developing modernity under your own steam according to your own dynamic and having it imposed forcefully and far too rapidly from outside.
You rebut, of course, in this book, and we've talked about this all the way through the program, that the idea in the West that religion is inherently violent. You've given many examples of why we can't and shouldn't lay violence at the door of religion. But the reverse, some people I hear saying the reverse may be is true, which is that religion perhaps is not doing as much as it could to promote peace.
I think this is something I shall be talking about at the Parliament. I think we all of us have to do what, whether we're Muslim, Christian, Mormon, Jewish, we've all got principles which tell us to love our enemies, to reach out to those in pain, and to practice the golden rule. And I think we're always saying how peaceable our religions are. We need to show that to the world in a much more forceful way, not just leaving it up to the religious leaders. All of us, whatever our faith, have to do more to activate that compassionate message that is inherent in all our faiths and make it a dynamic, active force in our dangerously polarized world.
And the vehicle for this, is that the Charter of Compassion that you're working on?
That was my idea for
yes.
it, to bring it, the Charter was written, composed not by me. It's a short document. You can read it on charterforcompassion.org. It was written by leading activists and thinkers representing six of the major world religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism. And it's a statement that compassion is central to our spirituality, central to our morality. It means practicing the golden rule all day and every day, as Confucius said, and not confining it to our own particular group. We have to have concern for everybody, even, as Jesus said, even our enemies. And somehow we've got lots of things are happening. One of the leaders of the Charter actually is Pakistan, where they've created a network of schools of compassion to train the leaders of tomorrow. There are now 75 of these schools, and every 3 months, two teachers from the school has to go for a weekend of training somewhere in Pakistan, and compassionate teaching has been integrated into core subjects of the curriculum. They say they will soon have 1,000 schools and be reaching 1 million growing children. We've got to take action on this front. One of the things that we're doing is creating a network of cities of compassion, and where the mayor endorses the charter, and promises to implement it practically in daily life. One of the Karachi in Pakistan is one of these cities. So too is Louisville, and the mayor of Louisville will be at the parliament this coming week. They're concentrating on homelessness, for example, and they have they've bought a Holiday Inn, which they've put at the disposal of the homeless. They've also developed a mentoring program. There's a lot of disaffection in the black community, whereby older kids take under their wing troubled younger kids. There are all kinds of initiatives of this sort going forward to bring compassion to the forefront of our ethical and moral, political and private life.
So you're focusing on practical things.
Yes. Yes, it's not enough just to sit and say, I'm a compassionate person, or concentrate on feeling. It has to be translated into action. Jesus said, not those of you who say, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom, but those who fed, I was hungry, you gave me to eat, thirsty, you gave me to drink, sick, naked, and in prison, and you visited me. Action. Someone asked me once, what should a compassionate city be like? And I said, it should be an uncomfortable city. The Prophet Muhammad once said, not one of you can be a believer and if he can sleep when he knows that somebody is hungry. And we are looking at suffering on a worldwide scale. Look at the migrants who are literally dying in their efforts to get into Europe, fleeing war zones, fleeing countries that can no longer support the population in Africa, for example. Instead of closing our hearts and doors to these people, somehow we have to realize that they are our brothers and sisters, and we have to coexist in respect on this planet.
Well, we're at the end of our time. By the way, are you working on another book? What can we look forward to?
I'm sorry?
Are you working on another book?
Next one? I'm just researching now a book about religion and the body.
Oh, interesting.
The role the body has always played in religion, both in its spirituality, the way we have seen the divine enshrined in the human person, and it's also dealing with questions of sex and gender and death. Of course, the body dies. And I feel that we're not necessarily in modern society dealing with death, old age, and sickness as compassionately as we should.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Karen Armstrong, her latest book is Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence. It's out in paperback with a postscript dealing with some recent happenings. Karen Armstrong, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Join us tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.
Next up is Bread and Butter, a culinary chronicle with Lael Gilbert.
How do you tell if food is good? I'm not talking about the kind of good where you prefer strawberry gelato over steamed asparagus. I mean the kind of good that isn't bad. The kind of good you can chew food and swallow it without the risk of getting sick. Food waste is a major problem in our country. Between 25 and 40% of food grown, processed, and transported in the U.S. will never be consumed. All that food goes straight from the field or the kitchen to the landfill, where it becomes a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. More wasted food reaches the landfill, in fact, than any other single material in our garbage cans. More than product packaging, grass clippings, fall leaves, or even outdated Justin Bieber posters. We are careful. No one wants to get sick from foodborne microbes. You throw out food when you think it's no longer edible. But how can you tell when that forgotten carton of Greek yogurt from the back of the fridge is no longer edible? If you're like most people, you use the numbers stamped on the side, the expiration date. But it turns out that expiration dates aren't all that helpful. They're an indication of quality, not safety. They tell you when food is supposed to taste its best according to the manufacturer. When you see a sell-by date, it indicates to the store how long to keep that item on the shelf. If the date passes, the store pulls it and discards it or donates it. That date represents the manufacturer's best guess at the last day the food is at peak quality for freshness, taste, and consistency. Generally, you may notice a difference after that date, but it is still fine to eat. For example, sour cream may become more sour or peanut butter may start to separate, but that doesn't necessarily mean you should throw it out. So how can you tell whether or not to eat food after the expiration day has passed? One way is to use your senses. Smell it, look at it, even taste it. Does it smell funky? Can you see mold? Does it taste bad? But even then, slimy, stinky, spotty, or chunky changes in food doesn't mean very much in terms of food safety. Just because it doesn't taste good doesn't mean it's going to make you sick, according to food experts. That's because there's a difference between what food scientists call spoilage bacteria and pathogens. Spoilage bacteria make themselves known by way of slimy films on lunch meat, soggy edges on vegetables, or stinky smell of chicken. But pathogens that are truly dangerous to your body are odorless, colorless, and invisible. But spoilage clues can be useful because they could mean something else has been growing there too. In other words, if it has been in the fridge long enough to get slime, there's a chance that pathogens have also had a chance to grow. A good rule of thumb for meats and leftovers is 4 days at 40 degrees Fahrenheit. If your fridge is cold enough, and you should check what temperature yours operates at because a lot of them are too warm, then even the most finicky of foods are perfectly edible for 4 days. But what about other foods? If it isn't slimy or stinky, are consumers simply at the mercy of the stamp date? Trinette Carlisle, a longtime volunteer at Cache Community Food Pantry, doesn't think so. This organization relies on donated cans and boxes that have exceeded their official shelf life. Volunteers accept everything given to them, then use their senses to determine which foods are still good to eat. Here's Carlisle's advice. If you have a can past the expiration date, examine it. It shouldn't be bulging and shouldn't squirt when you open it. Look at the product inside. If it smells and tastes normal, it's likely still good to eat. But you have to take special care with anything that has tomatoes or meat in it, as there is a risk of botulism with these low-acid foods, and you can't smell or taste botulism. When you open a bottle of fruit, listen for the pop to let you know if it was sealed. If the fruit tastes like it has soda in it, don't continue to eat it. That means the sugars have begun to convert to alcohol, and it could make you sick. Once again, it is better not to taste tomatoes if you aren't sure about their quality since they have a lower acid level than most fruit, and you can't taste botulism. Things like salad dressing, mustard, and hot sauces can be used quite a bit past their expiration dates because they contain a lot of vinegar, which prevents bacterial growth. But not mayonnaise, because it contains egg product. If a food is discolored or smells strange, best to throw it out. Yogurt, sour cream, and eggs in their shells can last quite a bit past their dates, but the quality will change slightly. Once you unseal a package, use it up quickly, and be sure to keep it in the fridge as much as possible, not sitting out on the dinner table or countertop. Breads are easy because mold is easy to smell and see. Eating a bit of mold won't make you sick unless you have an allergy. Keep breads without preservatives in the fridge. You can even cut off and throw away moldy portions and continue to use the rest, said Carlisle. The point is to be a smart consumer. Know your food enough to know when it is edible and when it should be discarded. It will make for less waste and more food on the table for everyone. This is Lael Gilbert for Bread and Butter.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.